Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net, joined remotely yet again by my anti-meet-cute rom-com co-host, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. And Charlie, did you skip all the fun, cheesy, fluffy stuff this week?
I am not anti-meet-cute. It just happened that everything I watch is about political intrigue and murder. But you can have meet-cutes with political intrigue and murder.
Yeah, but I think what I saw this week, you would have had a lot more fun, or at least I think I probably had the more entertaining viewing experience with what I chose this week, at least for what we didn't both happen to see at the same time.
Well, this week is saturated. There are so many films coming out this weekend that if you can't find something to watch, you just don't like movies. And the amount of Golden Globes and SAG Awards that these films are nominated for is a truckload. And that's not even including the four that you watched that would never be considered for awards. And I mean, this is the ones that I watched, and two of them that we actually combined on. You know, and compared to, I was looking ahead to next week. Next week is barely anything. It's like a desert. We have to find things. And this week, there are too many things to talk about this week, almost for one episode. I don't know why February 12th is such a, is it because it's a 3-day weekend? Is it because it's Valentine's Day?
It's, I don't know,
loaded.
It's loaded, and it's so loaded that even for all the things we did see, there were plenty that we did not. And so, you know, this is just a limited view of all the things that were being released on the 12th.
All right, well, let's just kick it off. Probably the biggest film this week. It's being released in select theaters and on HBO Max. It's in that Warner Brothers deal with HBO Max, so it's there for 31 days before they take it away. And it was at Sundance this year, and it's been nominated for a couple Golden Globes and a SAG Award. Judas and the Black Messiah. The Black Messiah being a J. Edgar Hooverism, which was already referenced earlier a couple weeks ago when we watched the documentary MLK FBI. The Black Messiah is Fred Hampton. We saw Fred Hampton already in a film this year. He was sitting behind Bobby Seale in the trial of the Chicago 7. So if you saw that movie and you didn't know about Fred Hampton, well, you already actually know what happens to Fred Hampton. And it's not a spoiler. It's not a spoiler to say Fred Hampton was assassinated by the FBI in 1969. Judas and the Black Messiah, directed by Shaka King, is the how they assassinated him, the why they assassinated him, and the how was through Bill O'Neill, played by Lakeith Stanfield. Bill O'Neill was strong-armed. The FBI made him an offer he couldn't refuse. You know, he was going up for Grand Theft Auto and impersonating a federal officer. And they said, how about instead of 6 years in the slammer, you join the Black Panther Party and you tell us what they're doing? What are their intentions? What are their plans? And especially focus on this Fred Hampton fellow. We hear he is a uniter, a visionary. And man, he is, played by Daniel Kaluuya. You know Daniel Kaluuya from Get Out, probably the most successful horror film in the last 5 years. He's magnetic. He gets up on the stage. He owns the room. He has presence. And the reason the FBI is so afraid of him is because he did something I didn't know he did. He brought together the Rainbow Coalition. He brought together Black street gangs, Latino street gangs, white gangs, all under the same banner of, you know what, we're all disenfranchised. We're all minorities in our own way. None of us have access to the levers of power. And J. Edgar Hoover saw, whoa, if he can bring all of those people together, he could tear it down. He could disrupt the social fabric of this country. And he had him murdered, is pretty much Judas and the Black Messiah. It is a pit in, it's a pit in your stomach to watch this film because you know where it's going. And it's so well acted. It's so strong and hard to watch at points, but it's one of those movies, Hannah, that you owe it to yourself to watch.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's really good performances, but it's a tough, slow watch. And I really was more interested in reading the actual story afterwards. After I finished watching this film, I went back and looked at some articles. And so this was a story that I was not familiar with. And I've spent time in Chicago, but I did not realize that this guy, Fred Hampton, he was chairman of the Illinois Black Panther Party. He had ambitions for really was in line to be in the leadership and the national leadership of the Black Panther Party, and to realize that he was betrayed by this FBI informant, William O'Neill, who, you know, I think he's the more layered character as the Judas in this story, really, is, you know, I think he was conflicted. Here he had made a deal with the FBI, was being an informant, but was also, I think, became the head of security for the Illinois Black Panther Party, and befriended Fred Hampton and Fred Hampton's pregnant girlfriend. And so, you know, it's really a very interesting dynamic, and to understand what decisions he was making and why, and perhaps how it stuck with him, that he did not get off scot-free. I think what was most interesting to me were the postscripts at the end of this film, where they gave you the sort of where are they now and what happened to some of these other people, to Hampton's girlfriend, to Fred Hampton Jr., who was born shortly after his father was assassinated, and that Hampton was only 21, and to realize what he had already managed to do and the future that he might have had. I did find this just a very compelling watch, and it is indeed one of those movies that you should watch, even if you don't particularly want to.
You mentioned you didn't know or hadn't heard of Fred Hampton, and I hadn't heard of him until 2015, when he was part of the documentary The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. And that's where I first heard his name and what happened to him. And then I realized, you know, Fred Hampton, he's not taught in school. You know, Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, Eldridge Cleaver, heard all of them, learned all about them, but no Fred Hampton. Why is that? And Shaka King, the director, he says they'll never teach him in school, especially public school, because then our country would be forced to confront the idea of government-sanctioned assassination of a private citizen, which is exactly what they did in this case, which is why it's so shocking. It's so shocking that what they did and pretty much got away with it. There is a postscript that there were some court cases involved, but people, you know, no one went to jail over this, and how they murdered him. He wasn't caught in crossfire. They murdered this kid, this 21-year-old kid. And J. Edgar Hoover, played by Martin Sheen here, he's quite a scary version of Hoover here. You know, they're showing the FBI, you know, brutally trying to quell the civil rights movement. And that's another thing that, I don't know, if it's not taught, it's certainly ignored nowadays. We had this very powerful government entity trying to quell the civil rights movement. And some people would say it's still happening today, but certainly not to the extent that it was in 1969.
Yeah, I mean, we did already know the racist tendencies of the 1960s FBI by having just watched that MLK/FBI doc a few weeks back. And so this was sort of more of the same, to just get your blood boiling. I mean, the reason nobody was really... it took years for there even to be an acknowledgement that this was anything other than a guy caught in a police raid or a law enforcement raid in the middle of the night. And as you discover more and more about really how this was all set up, that's when you just get, I think, angrier and angrier, and unfortunately more distrustful of what you are told by government entities. And so, definitely. And Martin Sheen, totally unrecognizable at first. You're like, this is a very creepy looking Martin Sheen as J. Edgar Hoover. I would note too, though, that when we talk about awards and where this could fit in, the one sure bet is that best original song in the mix, Fight for You by her.
It's a great song that they play over the end credits. I've been listening to it a couple of times this week after I saw the film, and yeah, it holds up. That's a great song. Her, actually, I listened to her album, and I've heard of her because she'd been nominated for a bunch of Grammys that are coming up, and there's certainly a reason. It's a very powerful song. Mm-hmm. All right, let's stay with Keep Your Blood Boiling, because our next one is also political intrigue, government up to shenanigans, and yeah, blood boiling. It's called The Mauritanian, and The Mauritanian in this case is Mohamedou Ould Slahi, played by Tahar Rahim. And in the first scenes, it's November 2001, so 2 months after 9/11, and he's arrested in his home country of Mauritania and sent to Guantanamo Bay, and he doesn't know why. He's like, I haven't done anything. I wasn't involved in 9/11. I certainly wasn't on the plane, and I didn't organize the plane, so why am I being arrested and interrogated and tortured? He doesn't know, and they don't tell him for a very long time, and he's never charged. He's not charged. So Jodie Foster, based on a true story, she's playing a real life person, Nancy Hollander. She takes this case pro bono, ACLU type of thing. She goes down to Guantanamo. She's like, hey, guilty or not, the United States of America has a constitution and we have due process of the law. And they don't make it easy for her. We see all the red tape and the bureaucracy that she has to go to just to see him and get his side of events. And that's most of the 2 hours of the film is flashbacks of his side of his journey in Guantanamo. And most of it, the gut-wrenching parts is the torture of them trying to extract a confession and names. And eventually, as everybody does, we'd learned this, 2 years ago in The Report, starring Adam Driver, that confessions under torture, there's a reason they don't hold up, because people just tell you whatever they want. They'll give you any names, which is why the Mauritanian, Mohamedou Slahi, he was named by another guy undergoing torture. That guy said Mohamedou was the guy. He recruited the 9/11 attackers on the plane into the South Tower. That was him. He recruited them while he was a student in Germany. No, he didn't. He was in jail for 14 years, never charged, and he didn't do it. And the prosecutor in the case, very interesting, I don't get your take on the casting on this, very interesting casting of Benedict Cumberbatch as the Southern Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Prosecutor, Lieutenant Colonel Stu Couch. He knew one of the pilots on the planes, which is why they tapped him. He's like, hey, take this personally, get this guy the death penalty. And as he's digging into the facts, as Jodie Foster, as Nancy's digging into the facts, they realize, well, something stinks here. The torture here is not going to hold up in court. We have a problem. So The Mauritanian will make your blood, made my blood boil. Just another reminder, another film. This is not the first film to do it, to say Guantanamo and torture actually hurt the quest for truth. It hurt the search for justice. It set us back. So not a great film, but right. A film effective, I think, at delivering most of its message.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's another one of those ones that, okay, I'm glad I saw it. I was not familiar with this particular story. We've seen elements of it before in The Report, in Zero Dark Thirty. So there was nothing like exceptionally new other than just the angle of this particular person's personal story and the lawyer. But Benedict Cumberbatch, total distraction for me to have him with his deep Southern accent. It just, the moment he opened his mouth in this movie, I just kind of chuckled, and I don't think that's the intent. And so I do have an issue with why. Like, really, that, why couldn't they find some actor with a real Southern accent to play this role? I don't think it needed to be Benedict Cumberbatch.
I didn't have a problem with him. I saw him do a similar weird accent way back in, what was it, 2013 with August Osage County, and he was fine there, and he's okay.
It's fine, and he's okay, but and the other underwritten, what is she doing in this movie? Not much, is Shailene Woodley as sort of like this legal assistant, and so she really didn't have much to do here at all.
I had a huge problem with her. Acting, with the way her character's written. I think she's a lawyer. She comes off as like a paralegal, but she's. I think she's actually co-counsel. And she gets into it with Nancy, with Jodie Foster, because Jodie Foster's like, it doesn't matter if he's guilty. He still deserves due process under the law. And once he might be guilty, once Shailene Woodley thinks he might be guilty, she gets very upset and doesn't want to stay on the case. I'm like, wait a minute, you're a lawyer. You're his lawyer. This ain't your first rodeo, or is it? And she has to be taught again about like the first year law school. Like, you know, you work on behalf of your client. It's very strangely written. Like, she's supposed to be, I think, the audience in this situation, but it's so, it comes off as so unbelievable that a lawyer would go through kind of her little character arc, what she goes through. It doesn't work at all.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, I wouldn't go so far also as to say it's clear cut that, that this guy, that Slahi didn't have some ties over the years to terrorist organizations. I think that's pretty clear that there was some tangential stuff there that they could tie him to, but you have to have some due process. You can't just keep somebody. It's just not the American way. It's not supposed to be to keep somebody in detention and being tortured for like 14 years without bringing charges. So the one thing that kept me watching this particular film was Tahar Rahim. I think his performance is really the most nuanced. He gets to be sort of a mix of charming and a little mysterious and just a little bit of everything. And so I think his performance helps carry what would otherwise be just a so-so movie.
Well, directed by Kevin MacDonald. We know him. He did The Last King of Scotland. Remember Forrest Whitaker as Idi Amin? And he did State of Play. So he knows political intrigue and he knows really huge character-driven films. Maybe it's just the script. Like the courtroom scenes were a little underwhelming. We've seen the torture scenes before, but it's you got to see them again just for this movie to work and hold and make you mad. You know, it only works. You're only going to get anything out of this movie if you get mad. Like, oh, how dare they? They hurt us in the end. And all these, you know, the original cancel culture. Remember the Dixie Chicks? That came into my mind here as anyways, that's a tangent. Mauritania is not the best of its genre, but I think it's passable.
It's a very familiar legal thriller with some good performances. And so, you know, again, an interesting story. And certainly if you have read Slahi's bestseller, you know, it was a best-selling memoir, Guantanamo Diary. So I would say that probably there's a good chance that if you did read that book or read his diary, then you'd be extra interested in seeing how this comes across on film.
Oh, and last thing I'm going to say about it, Zachary Levi's in the film, and talk about waste. What the hell is Zachary Levi doing in this movie?
I know, I had to go back and think, what was he in? You know, I saw his name in the credits. I'm like, where was he? So yeah, I would not consider him a big player here.
No. So those are the only two films that Hannah and I saw the same this week. We still have five films to talk about. She saw three of them. I saw two of them. And I think the biggest one, probably out of all of them, I would dispute this, but she can make a case, is something called Barb and Star. I don't know, something Del Mar. Why don't you fill me in, Hannah?
Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. And this one, you know, the one issue that I think some people will have with it is it's premium on demand. So if you don't have, you know, even if you have Netflix or something, you're not going to find this movie for free tomorrow if you're looking for it. Premium on demand usually means it costs about $20 to rent. But this is the movie that most of my gal pals all have asked me about over the past few days, whether I saw it, what I thought of it, because the trailer looks really funny, is basically what everyone said. It's getting raves from a lot of the women critics, especially. It's very campy. It's a comedy. It plays, I would say, like an overlong Saturday Night Live skit. And that's because it stars SNL alum Kristen Wiig, who we saw recently in Wonder Woman 1984.
Ugh.
And she's alongside Ami Mumolo. And the two of them actually are they collaborated and wrote Bridesmaids. Now, Bridesmaids is, you know, considered a very high bar, a classic, just a good comedy, drama, girl, you know, gal pal movie.
And it's got Rose Byrne in it.
And it has Rose Byrne in it. This one does not. This one has Wiig and Mumolo playing these longtime friends who go on this adventure of a lifetime when their dream jobs at a Jennifer Convertibles in their Midwest town. Their jobs go belly up. So they finally decide they're going to leave their town for the first time ever and, quote unquote, find their shimmer at this cheesy resort in Vista Del Mar, Florida, which is fictional, by the way. I had to look that up to find out whether this place existed. It does not. But it's Vista Del Mar is this hot spot for singles in their middle years. And so they go to this place. They're, you know, in some ways fish out of water. And they meet this hunky sad sack of a guy named Edgar, played by Jamie Dornan. So Here you have this wacky, campy comedy about female friendships. And you've got Jamie Dornan, who we saw recently in Wild Mountain Time. And is probably best known for being Christian Grey in the 50 Shades trilogy. This is a very different, this is Jamie Dornan unleashed in a campy comedy. And I think very odd casting, but I think they did everything very intentionally. So even if it's odd, I think they planned for it to be odd. Edgar was sent to Vista Del Mar by this evil villainess who wants to unleash these killer mosquitoes on Vista Del Mar as part of this revenge plot, because something happened to her years before in Vista Del Mar and she is going to take revenge. And even the plot itself, yeah, you know, the evil villainess unleashing killer mosquitoes on Vista Del Mar, you know that it's all very tongue-in-cheek. It's very silly. But there's enough flashes of really funny and heart that just gives it this ultimate escapist redemption that I think is why people are kind of giving it a pass on the fact that it's really stupid, silly in some parts. But, you know, it's ultimately, it's a movie about female friendship. And so it's going to appeal to those who drank up the 2019 Netflix movie Wine Country, which I don't think you ever saw.
And hell no.
I thought it was okay, but some people really enjoyed. And maybe Girls Trip from 2017, a little bit of that kind of gal pal comedy vibe in it. So I think if you keep your expectations in check, you can have a lot of fun with this movie. It's filled with cliches and a lot of oddball cameos that you kind of look for throughout. There's sage advice that they get from a talking crab on the beach named Morgan Freeman. And it's just, it has a very fun soundtrack. And then there's this whole tongue-in-cheek campaign to secure a Best Original Song nomination for I Love Boobies, which they actually go and watch that clip of the piano guy at the lounge playing this song. And that's what this movie is. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Does not try and take itself seriously at all, other than to just espouse the ultimate value of friendship. And so if you can embrace it all, if you can embrace the silly and the stupid with the humor and the heart, then, you know, this is a trip that that you'll enjoy.
Two things pop into my head during your description. First one is Mr. and Mrs. Costanza from Seinfeld. Are you saying we're not good enough for Del Boca Vista?
Exactly.
And the second one is that stupid David Spade movie, I think from last year, called The Wrong Missy, which takes place at this resort. It's a resort comedy, a terrible, terrible resort comedy. But, you compared it to Girls Trip, and you said you might have to temper your expectations. Well, the good thing is about Girls Trip, you don't have to temper your expectations. That's what launched Tiffany Haddish to fame and fortune. It's hysterical. It's one of the best comedies in the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. Girls Trip. You can't compare this to Girls Trip.
No. Girls Trip had the actual narrative. It had a story to go with it that held together decently and was surrounded by heart and comedy. This one is tongue in cheek, is campier all the way through, and it's just, you know, you just constantly laugh out loud at the stupidest little things. You go, oh, I think they're aiming for like a Gidget Goes Hawaiian kind of vibe in one scene, and then another thing with Morgan Freeman with a D to differentiate this philosophical turtle from a certain other, you know, famous person who you might expect to be hearing from with this voice. There's the appearance by Tommy Bahama, who I'm pretty sure was Andy Garcia. It just, you know, just when you think you're done with it and that it's gone off the rails, they just managed to stick something in there that makes you laugh. And that's why I think certainly gal pal types will ultimately enjoy it.
Well, the film I watched that you should probably have watched instead, because it's probably more your style, is Land, pretty much a solo female picture, directed by first-time feature film director Robin Wright. You know Robin Wright. She was Jen A from Forrest Gump, and she was Princess Buttercup from Princess Bride. This was also at Sundance alongside Judas and the Black Messiah. Land, it's actually also your type of movie because it's only 89 minutes long. At the beginning of the film, Robin Wright, as Edie. Edie has undergone some sort of tragedy. You don't know what it is yet, but it was pretty big. It's big enough that she's leaving the city. She's a city girl. She gets this U-Haul, packs it up with a bunch of survival supplies, throws her cell phone in the trash, and she moves to this cabin on the top of a mountain in the Rockies. They say it's Wyoming. It's actually Alberta. Everything's filmed in Alberta. But make pretend we're in the Rockies in Wyoming. The guy who sells it to her is like, "You sure you want to stay up here all by yourself? It's pretty rough." She's like, yeah, I'm ready to do this. I'm going to do this. She's fine for a while, and then winter hits. She's not fine anymore. She's dying. She's starving. She has a run-in with a bear. This mountain's killing her. And she's very close to death when she's found by Miguel, Demian Bashir. And he brings her back to life. He saves her. And, you know, she didn't want anybody around. He says, "Look, I get it. You want to be left alone. You don't want anybody around. But let me teach you the skills you need to survive. I'll teach you how to trap, teach you about water, about how to hunt. And then I'll leave you alone. Rest of your life, you can stay up here as the hermit on the mountain." And it's kind of that. It's very montage-y. You know, you can imagine how montage-y this is when you have to learn skills. Dialogue is few and far between. It's sparse, but a sexual relationship, a platonic relationship develops between Edie and Miguel, and it's very respectful, and they're talking about their lives and past lives, and they do have a lot in common. So it's a very isolated, insular, you know, let's look at the landscape kind of film, because it's beautiful, and they take a lot of time just to look out at the landscape, which is why I figured, oh, this Hannah would totally get into this movie. So, and I'm the one who ends up watching this movie? Come on.
I don't know. I think, do I want to hang out at a quirky beach resort for 2 hours looking at Jamie Dornan? Or do I want to spend 90 minutes in a remote cabin with a distraught woman? I don't know, Charlie. I can't even imagine why I would choose one over the other.
Because this is strong, independent, female-led business. I mean, she's out there on her own. I am woman. Man.
Oh, come on. You know, you've got this is Barb and Star. That's that is Kristen Wiig and Annie Mimola. That's their this is them. They created this whole thing. They got it made. So these are their characters. So, no, I actually again, if Land, and maybe I'll try and catch up with it for next week, because we do have a lot less to choose from next week. So maybe this would be the kind of one that I'd rather go back and catch up on something that I might like, rather than really scrape the bottom of the barrel to watch something that I might not particularly care for. So we'll see. I might try and watch Land, because I do want to support the effort. But
and I want to emphasize, I did like Land. I didn't love it, but I really, really liked it. I found it an enjoyable watch. Robin Wright she's directed episode of House of Cards, like 10 episodes, but you know, hour long episodes that have already been in production for a while is a lot different than bringing together your first feature film, especially one that you actually filmed outside in the elements in the snow. So she's got some chops. So Land, yes, it's far from bottom of the barrel.
No, I'm sure not. And I'm a big fan of Robin Wright. So again, it was just picking your poison this week, and I went for light fluff.
Well, speaking of light and fluff, Are we going to talk about the young adult thing on Amazon or the young adult thing on Netflix that you watched?
Let's start with the young adult thing on Amazon, because I think that's the other one that that's kind of new to the scene for and people can actually watch if you have Amazon Prime, The Map of Tiny Perfect Things. And talk about sort of something feeling familiar. There is no shortage of movies featuring a time loop or temporal anomaly. This is another one, but it's another YA version. So, you know, there's Groundhog Day, there's 12 Dates of Christmas, Before I Fall. Remember that one?
I do remember that now.
Edge of Tomorrow, Happy Death Day. There's tons. But so you will, without a doubt, feel a certain sense of deja vu watching The Map of Tiny Perfect Things. But what makes it somewhat different is that it's based on a short story and by this guy, Lev Grossman, who also penned the screenplay. And it's this very pleasant fantasy, romantic dramedy, firmly targeted to the YA crowd. And the twist in this one is that the time loop is actually viewed as something to embrace and not necessarily escape, at least for a while. Repeating the same day over and over and over again kind of offers this chance to sort of look for and appreciate the little things in life. And so it starts with this teenager named Mark, Kyle Allen from American Horror Story. He is trapped in this time loop. He seems very content to live the same day over and over again. He's fully aware when the clock strikes midnight, the day's going to reset. The same cast of characters are going to appear. And then suddenly, though, one day, he spots the mysterious Margaret, played by Catherine Newton from Big Little Lies, and we saw her in Blockers a while back. She's stuck in that same time loop, and she also has reasons for keeping the clock at bay. And Mark and Margaret end up going on this journey to find all the tiny things that make one day perfect. And of course, they fall for each other in the process because, come on, that's what's going to happen in this kind of movie. And so then it becomes a question of, do they try to find out the key to escaping this never-ending day? Do they want to? We don't, you know, that's the question. And so The Map of Tiny Perfect Things won't rock your world, but it's cute. It's, you know, it's a temporal anomaly meet cute.
Well, if you're going to catch up on Land, then I think I will catch up on Map of Tiny Perfect Things, because I remember I was just gushing a couple weeks ago over Palm Springs, which was also nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Comedy or Musical, and that sounds nothing like Map of Tiny Perfect. It's a lot dirtier, but I guarantee you it's a lot funnier, because, you know, Andy Samberg. But I love time loop movies. I love them, so I need to be a completist about this, and I need to see this movie.
Yeah, no, and it's one of those ones that there's no harm in seeing it. Like, even, you know, I kept thinking that even you would probably be okay with it, even though it's got that sort of meet cute vibe. It's cute. It's cute. And so, yeah, I think you'd be okay with watching that one.
All right, well, let's talk about, even though we've talked about Judas and the Mauritanian and Land, I want to talk about my favorite film of the week. I gushed over Judas, and it's not even close to my favorite film of the week. That's because I want to talk about French Exit, starring Michelle Pfeiffer and Lucas Hedges as a mother and son duo, and a very strange mother and son duo. Michelle Pfeiffer, who's knocking it out of the park. Everyone's loving Michelle Pfeiffer in French Exit. She is a widow. You know, not the oldest widow you've ever heard of. She's Michelle Pfeiffer widow. And the money has run out. She was not frugal. She was not thrifty. She was born into wealth. She married for money. She just never thought about money. She didn't care. You know, it's too banal for her. And, you know, her accountant saying it's gone. It's gone. We have to sell everything. And here's what's left over. Here's the cash. And she says, fine, put it in euros and I'm going to Paris. So she takes Lucas Hedges. You know, he was from Manchester by the Sea, Boy Erased, Ben Is Back. Oh.
Love Lucas Hedges.
And he is this kind of like this dilettante. You know, he was at boarding school for the first like 12, 13 years of his life. Didn't know his mom or dad, really. They just shoved him off in school. And she picks him up one day. And it's like, hey, you know, you want to come with me? You want to have a good time? So this is what happens when you parent a child this way. He's very aloof. He's very stoic. He's very just observant. And it's, you know, when you move to Paris, you think, get on a plane and fly to Paris, right? No, they get on the boat. They're going to ship over. I didn't know people still did this, but and this is where French Exit just kind of did just hit me. I love screenplays like this. It racks up this miscast oddball coterie of supporting characters. It reminded me of Wes Anderson a bit. You know, they run into this this ship's fortune teller, this clairvoyant, and she actually gives people bad news. It's like, oh, I never heard of a, you know, that's not the game. Never heard of a fortune teller giving bad news. And she can talk to their cat. They bring their cat, and apparently the cat has the consciousness of the dead husband inside of it. They get to Paris and they meet a private investigator. They meet this socialite who's very, very lonely, played by Valerie Mahaffey. She's really funny. Lucas Hedges broke up with his fiance. That was Imogen Poots in a very small role. And all these supporting characters just kind of start hanging out at their apartment and not leaving, and they have no reason to be there. And it just becomes this absurdity, stacked on absurdity. And it's so droll and dry, and it's not funny, it's funny, wow, that was really well written. And Frances, Michelle Pfeiffer's character, has this ulterior motive of what she's doing there and the money that's slowly dwindling in the closet drawer. And I don't want to give too much away, but it's, you know, it's under 2 hours for you there, Hannah. I really think you need to take the time for French Exit. I'm the only one who's really giving this like 4 stars, A. It does have a fresh tomato, but it's more like everyone's like, you know, 3 stars, B. But I don't know, for whatever reason, this quirky little script out of this off-the-wall film has just ignited a fire in me. I love this movie.
Well, we all know that you've been missing all your French cinema, so maybe this is the closest you'll get for a while. And I love I like Michelle Pfeiffer. I'm a huge fan of Lucas Hedges. There was just something about the description of this movie that just did not appeal to me. Artie Chick reviewed it for Chick Flicks, so I didn't feel compelled to see it. I think she raved mostly about Michelle Pfeiffer's performance. She said it was worth seeing to just be reminded of what a good actress she is, and that maybe we need to be seeing more of her in good roles. So maybe, but if I had to choose between Land and French Exit, what would I choose, Charlie?
Well, I you know my vote there, and I'm, you know, it's, I don't know if there's technically a wrong answer. I mean, they're both good, but Michelle Pfeiffer was nominated for this. Robin Wright was not. So if you want to be in the conversation. Gotcha. And your boy Lucas Hedges kind of let us down. He was in an interview this week, and he, you know, he's not the youngest guy, but you know, he's certainly not my age either. He said he had never ever seen a Michelle Pfeiffer film before, not one Michelle Pfeiffer film. Well, like what? You didn't see her as Catwoman? I mean, come on, man.
No, I can see where he would fall right after. You know, like he is. He's of that age. He's probably still in his mid-20s, maybe?
Maybe late 20s. I don't know. Maybe mid to late 20s. But what, he didn't see her in 2007 Stardust? I mean.
Yeah, you know.
She hasn't fallen. Where is Kira? That film floored me like 2-3 years ago.
Oh, that's right. I remember that one. Even I like that one, I think. But yeah, it's. But I can see there are just times in our lives where we just kind of miss out that maybe we're just not catching certain things that that you look back at years later and go, how did you not see this TV show? How did you not see this movie?
And he's an actor. You're supposed to, you know, go back and kind of get familiar with Scarface.
I don't know. See, I'm always sort of like, let's just move forward. If I miss something, if somebody can't give me like a really, really good justification for why I need to go back and watch something. There are just too many things. I mean, you could go back and find 1,000 movies. I mean, that's why people like you do go back. Jill, my writing partner for Chick Flicks, Jill Baniski, she loves going back and looking at classic films again and sort of rewinding her viewing habits from previous decades. And so I guess the problem is you have weeks like this one where we're supposed to watch like 8 different movies. And I'm like, how does anybody find time to go and watch something old again, to rewatch things? It's just time. We just need a time loop.
Because unlike you, we like movies.
No, I like movies, but I like what I like. I mean, I go back the ones, you know, hey, I'll go back and watch Sound of Music 100 times. I'll watch.
There's only so many times you can watch Sweet Home Alabama.
You know, I will watch Sweet Home Alabama if it's on TNT or TBS or something for the gazillion time. I will watch, that's just it. I will watch romantic comedies and romantic dramas that I liked over the years. If I see those again, I'll sometimes go back and watch an original version of something if a new one is being made. So that's kind of what I look for. I don't need to go and catch up on the fact that I don't think I actually ever did see The Godfather from beginning to end.
My God. I can't believe it. I can imagine the hate mail rolling in right
now. I know.
So I can't believe you just said that out loud. You just made Lucas Hedges feel better. Now no one's going to remember what he said.
That's right. I'm just trying. I'm all about making life easier for Lucas.
He appreciates you. Lucas, if you're listening to this, you owe Hannah a bottle of wine. All right. Finish us off. Tell me about that wonderful thing I didn't watch on Netflix.
So the one that you will never catch up on because it would require you to see the first two in this trilogy. And I don't think you have. It is on Netflix. It is the third of the To All the Boys films. So there is, I think there is To All the Boys and then To All the Boys, P.S. I Love You. And then this is To All the Boys, : Always and Forever.
That's
and
a lot of boys, Hannah.
It is out on Netflix now. It is, I was just talking about the sequel this time last year. So I think they must have shot the second and third installments very close together. They were produced back to back. And it is the final chapter in the story of Laura Jean Covey. And she, in the first two, she's sort of involved in these love triangles. She's kind of going back. She's in high school. She's going back through all the boys that she had crushes on over the years. And had sent these, she had written letters that were never intended to be sent, but then her little sister like mails them. And so then years later, all these guys get these love letters that she wrote when she was like in grade school. And so it's like, who is she going to end up with? Which ones are real? Which ones were just passing, you know, flirtations? Which ones were people who never even knew she was alive? So that's where this all started. And it's based on a novel by Jenny Han. And so this is continuing that same director, same screenplay by Katie Lovejoy, same actors. Lana Condor is Lara Jean. John Corbett is in it each time as her dad. And so while in the past, there's been sort of a focus on a love triangle between Lara Jean and some boys, in the second film, Lara Jean and the guy Jock Peter is who she ends up with. And they end up actually having a very serious, very sweet, romantic kind of story. And so this one picks up with them still together, and he's going off to Stanford on scholarship. She expects to get into Stanford, but does not. So then she's sort of looking at Berkeley and other colleges in the area. But then someone tells her, you know, you really should look at NYU. You want to be a writer. You might, you know, there's something about NYU in New York that might really stoke your future.
So she goes,
yeah. So she goes and looks at NYU and falls in love with NYU in New York. So the love triangle really becomes Lara Jean sort of torn between Peter and staying in California and sort of following her career passion path to go to New York. But you root for them. It's a very satisfying conclusion. You know, he's a good guy. I mean, this is just one of those, it is the next step. It's the meet cute times two. So you just keep the meet cute going and the romantic comedy drama going. And if you saw the previous installments of To All the Boys, you absolutely should see and will be happy to see Always and Forever. And it will probably make you even think about, the book might have been over. The story might have ended, but there's potentially more to be seen, you know, and more to explore in the future. And so these are just very endearing characters, and it's an easy watch. And so if you watch the first two, definitely go for it. Same cast, same vibe, and you know, you won't be disappointed.
I think I would be disappointed. It sounds nauseating. Sign me up for Morgan Freeman.
No, but that's just it. Is, you know, this is one where I did catch up on it. I watched the first two back to back last year when the second one came out. How can
you relish an easy watch after you watch Barb and Star and Map of Tiny Perfect Things? And I'm like, thank God for an easy watch. To All the Boys Part 3. I'm like, good Lord, Hannah, give yourself some meat.
I had some meat with the Mauritanian. I had some meat with the Black Messiah movie. So I had tons of, and doesn't even, I think, does Minari expand?
Minari expanded today, and even that, we don't even have time to talk about that.
Yeah, but that's another good one that if you just want to be in the know for award season, Minari's a good family film to catch. So no matter how you slice it, though, Charlie, there's something for everyone in the mix right now from out of all of these, and I'm not saying that that Barb and Star or that you know, To All the Boys is a better movie than Judas and the Black Messiah or the Mauritanian or any of those. I'm just saying that, you know, there are times where we're ready for the meat and potatoes, and then there are times that the appetizer and the dessert come into play, and that's what those movies are there for. And Barb and Star, for the gal pals out there, is your is your dessert.
Well, it sounds like your courses are inverted and that your appetizers and your dessert is actually your entree. And, you know, Judas is your, he's like the salad course.
Come on, have you never had dessert before dinner? Come on.
I have an 8-year-old, so I got to be like, I got to set an example and be like, no, there's more to life than cookies. But just a reminder, French Exit. I know we alluded to Minari, which is, you know, the critic's darling, and we alluded to Judas and all the other ones. I still put it, I put my marker down for French Exit.
And I have a really tough time because, again, I can't choose out of these. I would just say The Young Adults, Map of Tiny Perfect Things, and To All the Boys are your choices. The middle-aged women are going to get a huge kick out of Barb and Star. And the people who like the more serious fare, I think Judas and the Black Messiah and the Mauritanian, for just some really good performances and interesting true story reveals. That's what those are for.
All right. Well done.
And of course, you might also choose based on what's free with the streaming services that you have.
Touché. That's true. If you already pay for these streaming services, maybe you just want to stay with those.
There you go. So that's a wrap for this edition of the Cinema Clash. Thanks for listening. As always, if you have a question, a comment, need to vent to Charlie, shoot us a tweet or visit us at thecinemaclash.com. Till next time, wear a mask, watch your distance, wash those hands, and when it's your turn, please take the shot.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.